The University of Montana celebrates its birthday with the launching of a new program to help create successful entrepreneurs. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about Congressman Steve Daines' plan to strike portions of the Real ID law. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry looks at why some specially trained dogs are going to be sniffing out some boats. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with the co-author of a new report showing Montana women, even those with an education, are paid less than men. The University of Montana celebrated its 121st birthday today with a grand opening of a new organization that will train Montana's next generation of entrepreneurs. UM's Blackstone Launchpad is designed to help students start their own viable businesses. The Blackstone Charitable Foundation brought the Launchpad to the Missoula Mountain Campus, Montana State University, and Headwaters RC&D, a Butte-based economic development conservation management organization. The Launchpad is made possible by a three-year, $2 million grant from the Blackstone Charitable Foundation. UM Blackstone Launchpad Director Paul Gladen, himself an entrepreneur, says the program will help students of any academic background explore entrepreneurship as a viable career path.
And it does that by helping them pursue a business idea that they might have, supporting them with resources and guidance, connecting them with other business people in the community that can help them shape and explore and validate their business idea.
Gladen says even if a student's startup isn't an immediate success, they'll learn valuable skills in the process.
Because whether they start their own business or whether they join organizations, if they've got those entrepreneurial skills, they're going to be a real asset to the organizations that they join. But I think we have proof here in the business community that we have smart entrepreneurial talent at the University of Montana and that they have the ability to build their own businesses and create jobs for others at the same time.
UM President Royce Ingstrom agrees. He adds Montanans are independent thinkers and high-energy people.
They have a fantastic work ethic. So when you put all of those things together, especially in the context of the just world-class educational opportunities that students get here at the University of Montana, that's a recipe for creative things to happen. And I think we've seen so many great examples of students or alumni who have taken their idea, often initiated here at the university, and turned it into a great business.
Ingstrom noted UM, at 120 years old today, is still Montana's premier liberal arts-based research institution.
Certainly, the topics we teach today, the strategies and techniques we use in and out of the classroom, the vibrant research atmosphere on this campus, those are things that have developed over that 121 years into an absolutely first-class institution.
The Blackstone Launchpad is modeled on a similar program developed at the University of Miami in 2008, which has generated over 1,400 business proposals, created 210 jobs, and drawn almost 2,600 participants. Officials say UM's new Launchpad holds the potential of generating over 150 new ventures in Montana over the next 5 years.
And in other news from around the state, Montana Congressman Steve Daines is introducing a bill to repeal federal security mandates for state-issued ID cards like driver's licenses. The 2005 Real ID Act was passed in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. It requires certain security standards for the IDs themselves, as well as the buildings and employees who issued those IDs. Enforcement of the law gradually began taking effect in January, and Montana is not in compliance. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says rather than complying with the law, the state's political leaders want it scrapped.
In recent months, Montanans have become increasingly concerned about the federal government's access to Montana's personal information.
Montana's Congressman, Republican Steve Daines, at a press conference in the Capitol building's old Supreme Court chambers, he's unveiling his Repeal ID Act of 2014, which he says he will introduce in Congress next week.
Which ensures that no state has to comply with this federal intrusion and violation of privacy.
The Montana legislature unanimously voted in 2007 not to comply with the Real ID Act. 11 other states have made the same choice. With the law now starting to take effect over the next few years, it means Montana IDs will be accepted in fewer and fewer federally controlled areas. It culminates with commercial airlines refusing to acknowledge them no earlier than 2016 without a second form of ID. The Department of Homeland Security says secure IDs are a vital part of the nation's overall security strategy, saying travel documents are as important to terrorists as weapons. Montana Attorney General Republican Tim Fox joined Danes to unveil the repeal bill, the two of them standing next to a poster board featuring an oversized Montana driver's license. Fox says Montana takes the safety of its citizens from outside attacks seriously.
We've taken very positive steps through the years to make sure that Montana's driver's license, a sample of which you see here, and the process for applying for a driver's license and reapplying is very, very secure.
Some of the mandates of Real ID include standardizing photos, allowing law enforcement agencies to use facial recognition technology to catch criminal suspects. States would be able to share that information. The Real ID Act says this system would not create a national ID card, but privacy advocates say it's a stepping stone to that. Attorney General Fox says that's not what Montanans want, and the state system works fine as it is.
We do it well. We do it right. We don't need the federal government to tell us how to do it.
Montana's leading Democratic officials are also voicing their opposition. Senators John Tester, John Walsh, and Governor Steve Bullock are also calling for repeal of the Real ID Act. Two similar bills, also seeking repeal, failed in 2007. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
The state is appealing a ruling from a Lincoln County judge saying Montana's 24/7 sobriety program is unconstitutional. The program allows the courts to order people charged with two or more DUIs to pay for twice daily breath tests or an alcohol monitoring bracelet in order to avoid jail. The ruling of District Judge James Wheelis of Libby says the fees charged for the testing are indeterminate in that they can last for a few days or a few months. They are not reimbursable if the defendant is acquitted and cannot be used to offset a fine. Judge Wheelis says that amounts to pretrial punishment in violation of the defendant's due process rights. His ruling throwing the program out applies only in Lincoln County. Attorney General Tim Fox is appealing the ruling to the Montana Supreme Court. He believes the law has been applied all across the state in a uniform and legal way.
We want to make sure that we try to get this law vindicated, if you will, in the Montana Supreme Court. And if there are any changes that any court suggests that we may need, we'll take a look at that. But right now, the system is working.
26 counties are currently participating in the 24/7 sobriety program, which was started under the former Attorney General Steve Bullock. Supporters say it helps reduce the number of people driving under the influence of alcohol.
Specially trained dogs have sniffed out scat for endangered animals, noxious weeds in a field of grass and weeds, and invasive cannibalistic snails. So how about aquatic invasive species like zebra mussels? Flathead reporter Captain Fry has more on why you might see dogs at boat check stations across Montana this summer.
Pepin is an 8-year-old Belgian Malinois trained to identify about 19 different scents. In a demonstration at the Flathead National Forest Office, he's finding wolverine scat that Megan Parker placed out there earlier in the day. Parker is the director for research and also a co-founder of Working Dogs for Conservation. The Missoula-based group is in the Flathead to talk with the Flathead Basin Commission about how dogs like Pepin could help in the effort to stop aquatic invasive mussels and weeds from getting into the area.
They've proven themselves good at finding lots of things that are invisible to people, and we're wondering how useful dogs can be for something that are, you know, like an aquatic invasive that's invisible to people or is indistinguishable from another plant.
Parker says the dogs have an advantage because they're using their noses instead of their eyes and can catch things people can easily overlook. This idea wouldn't be brand new. California and Minnesota already have programs using dogs to sniff out zebra and quagga mussels.
Remember, the dog is supposed to sit if he finds it. So he's looking, checking all the spots out. Oh, seems like he might have found. There you go.
This clip from a news story on Minnesota's WCCO shows a specially trained dog sniffing out a zebra mussel on a boat. The mussels are small, usually the size of a fingernail, but they can grow up to 2 inches long. Parker says one of the challenges they'll have in teaching the dogs is discovering how good they are at sniffing out not just the fully grown mussels, but contaminated water.
You can see a mussel. So if a dog alerts on a mussel, a human could go, yes, good dog. But if a dog is alerting on even the water where some of these villagers, the microscopic baby mussels are, if dogs can identify that, how does the human know whether to reward the dog and whether, we know if there's a risk of, that contaminating a lake?
Parker says they'll need to discover how consistently the dogs can identify the mussels at different life stages. The dogs work for reward, a toy. Pepin has a tug-of-war toy he and his handler play with once he's found what he's sniffing for. Another application Parker says they've been training the dogs to do is to be able to find fish species in water. They're working on a project where fisheries managers are trying to get rid of brook trout in favor of rainbow trout.
We were testing to see if they can distinguish the two species, and yeah, they can. And what's more, they can just smell water that a fish has been in and identify that, the water.
Parker says they're still testing to see how effective the dogs could be as a tool in this type of work. If the conservation dogs are brought on board to sniff out aquatic invasive species in Montana, Parker says the first step is to go somewhere else to train them on the scent.
Because you cannot bring, for very good reasons, you cannot bring mussels into the state, even dead ones. So we have to find a place where they are contained, but they're available for us to train dogs on. And there is a site in Alberta, and there's Lake Mead, where we would go and do the testing and the training of the dogs there, and then bring them back to work at check stations.
It is illegal to transport aquatic invasive species, but Parker says their aim isn't going to be getting anyone in trouble.
People tend to think about dogs as, oh, they're searching my luggage, I might get in trouble. And I think that the perception is it needs to be out there. Like, we really want to stop this species from coming in, help us, and let us look to make sure that it's not in your vehicle. Like, you're not going to get in trouble. We just really need to, scrape it off.
Flathead Basin Commission Executive Director Karen Miske says they plan on having signs at check stations with dogs to explain what the dogs will be doing and that they're only sniffing for aquatic invasive species. The dogs would be at various check stations, but boats traveling between Montana and Alberta and Flathead area check stations would likely see the dogs. Miske says they'll know if the conservation dogs will be working to find aquatic invasive species by March, and then they'd hopefully be here in time for this summer's boating season. Funding would come mostly through grant dollars from both sides of the U.S.-Alberta border. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
Montanans are more likely to be poor compared with the rest of the nation, and women are more likely to be poor than men. That's just one of the sobering facts contained in a new report on the status of women in Montana, summarized in the winter issue of the Montana Business Quarterly. The report was co-authored by University of Montana sociology professors Celia Winkler and Kathy Keepers for the Women's Foundation of Montana. In this feature interview with news director Sally Mock, Professor Winkler talks about why Montana women make only 74% of what Montana men make, earning an average wage of $31,000 a year compared to $41,000 for men.
One of the areas where men are making a lot of job gains right now is in the Bakken, obviously in eastern Montana. Those are male-type jobs, and they're not very welcoming to women. Montana Public Radio did a great expose on that recently, and the way that those jobs require round-the-clock dedication, and that's not something that a lot of women are able to do because of care responsibilities.
Child care mostly.
Yes.
And in fact, there are women working in the Bakken, but they're doing like retail service kinds of things.
Right.
They're not out on the oil rigs.
Which is where the big...
There are few, but not many.
Well, that's where the big money is, though, on the oil rigs. It's not doing retail.
This really goes back to something you talk about in the report, which is occupational clustering.
Mm-hmm. Occupational clustering is the tendency for people to work in certain job categories. Women tend to cluster in care kind of jobs. Those are traditionally female-type jobs. Think of care, you can think of K-12 teaching, particularly K through middle school teaching is predominantly female. Nursing, child care, obviously, other types of service industry, food industry, those types of jobs tend to be female-typed. They're more welcoming to women. Frequently, those jobs have job schedules that will accommodate child rearing, which is still really been women's major responsibility.
Despite the fact that there are few stay-at-home moms anymore.
Right.
I mean, the fact is most women do work now.
Yeah.
And so both parents are working, but mm-hmm. the child care still falls to the woman.
For the most part, yes. I mean, there's some great men out there who are taking responsibility for the kids. Got to say that. It's wonderful. But if you look at the statistics, for the most part, women take on the bulk of child care. And that means getting home from work at a certain time, being available in case of an emergency, those types of things that are involved in, picking up the kids from daycare, settling them into sleep, those things.
So if you were to fix this, it seems like there are two sort of obvious things here. One is that something should be done to help the woman with child care, either the other parent
mm-hmm.
or better child care, affordable child care.
Right. Child care is not affordable. I mean, if you are working
$8,000 a year in Montana.
A minimum wage job. Child care takes up, pretty much all of that minimum wage job income. So you really can't count on your own wages to cover the cost of care.
In terms of the occupational clustering, what would be the solution there? Would it be to get more women into non-traditional jobs, or would it be to raise the pay of those traditional jobs?
I have a bias here, and that comes from just watching how things worked. And I've been in the labor force for decades, and I really haven't seen that entering into the non-traditional type work has really brought that much difference for women, although it has brought some difference. But still, even when women enter into, for example, they become an attorney, they're still in the lower income levels of attorney. They don't reach the high-flying, attorney level positions.
They make more than a child care worker would make.
Absolutely.
But they're still not making as much as their male counterpart.
Right. We still haven't solved the wage inequality. One of the reasons that women attorneys might be paid less than men is that, again, they tend to go into sort of like care type of attorney work, like are you in family law? Are they doing divorces? Are they doing child protective type work? Are they trusts and estates? Those types of jobs tend to pay less. The upper income attorney jobs just aren't welcoming to women, partially because of the job requirements, the time requirements, those types of things, and also because they tend to be very aggressive, and women are not socialized. There's a lot of great aggressive women, assertive women out there, but they're not. But for the most part, women are socialized not to be assertive.
One of the more stunning facts in your report, to me anyway, was that there are more Montana women graduating from college than men.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not gaining them in terms of wages compared to men.
Compared to men. It's still really doing great things for their income. I mean, if women with a college education do earn a lot more than women without one. But still, at the same educational level, women will earn less than men.
And there was one fact in there that a woman who graduates from high school will make less than a man who didn't graduate from high school.
Well, part of, again, is that some jobs are valued more than other jobs by society or by employers. And there's a tradition of paying some jobs more than others. The example that I often give in my classes is the difference between a certified nurse's assistant and somebody who picks up garbage, the sanitation workers.
Sanitation workers earn much more
than the CNA, while the CNA often has training requirements, educational requirements, in addition to having a lot of the same job duties as a sanitation worker and more skill requirements.
So would one solution be then that jobs that are traditionally female should just be paid more?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that's the key to the whole problem. We need to start valuing the kinds of jobs that women have traditionally done. And as we do that, actually, we see more men entering those jobs. For example,
and that will raise the wages, right?
Yeah, actually, yeah. The registered nurses, for example. We see many more men entering that profession now that it has become more valued and is paid more. So that's another way of breaking down the job clustering.
Your report pointed out that there are a lot of politicians who think that there is no gender disparity. They think gender equality is here and therefore not doing much in terms of policy about it.
You know, what they often rely upon is human capital theory. And do you mind me going into that?
I don't know. Go ahead and we'll see. We'll see how much I mind.
Okay. Human capital theory says that people are paid according to their skill, education, and other qualification years on the job. And so that if women had the same years on the job and put in the same number of hours as men, then they would be paid comparable. So they see that the wage disparity as an artifact of women's more reduced commitment to their jobs. The Congress in 1938 said that a full-time job is 40 hours a week. But even when women work 40 hours a week, that's considered not enough to earn them the higher wages. We're supposed to somehow work more than full-time in order to get by. And I think that's another sort of a structural problem that applies to both women and men.
The upshot of the whole report is that we have a long way to go.
Yeah.
If we're going to close this wage gap.
There was a movement many years ago to introduce comparable worth readjustment to wages.
Equal pay for comparable worth.
Yes. So that you would actually just take a look and see what are the skills, what are the education involved in each job, and what are the demands, physical demands, other types of demands that are placed on each job. Is it dangerous and so forth? And then rate those jobs according to that scale and then pay according to that scale. Now, that is in opposition to our sort of market approach to jobs, that people are supposedly paid what an employer thinks they're worth. That's a big hurdle to overcome, that particular ideology.
One hopes that studies like this that point out what is really clearly to anyone, I think, a disparity that is not doing anybody any good. It's not doing women any good. It's not doing their families any good. And in the end, it's really not doing our economy any good either.
No, no, because the more money that we have, that people have to spend, the better our local economy will do. The retailers will do better. The landlords will do better. I mean, everybody will do better if people have money in their pocket.
Well, I have been speaking with Celia Winkler, who's a professor of sociology at the University of Montana, who co-wrote this report with her colleague Kathy Kuipers on the status of women in Montana. And it looks at both the economic status and also the safety and health status, which we didn't get into, but we will at another time, I'm sure. Professor Winkler, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with lows 19 to 26 degrees. Tomorrow, snow with rain is likely with highs in the upper 30s to mid 40s. In central Montana, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 a.m. Saturday for the Rocky Mountain Front. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with lows 20 to 30 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 50 miles per hour. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow and highs 35 to 45 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 35 miles per hour in the afternoon. And in southwest Montana, there's a winter weather advisory in effect from noon tomorrow to 5 a.m. Saturday for Beaverhead, Madison, and Gallatin counties. Tonight, look for increasing clouds with a slight chance of snow and lows 15 to 25 degrees. Wind gusts could be up to 55 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be cloudy. Mountain snow is likely through the day with areas of blowing snow in the afternoon. Expect highs 35 to 45 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Evan Barrett. We'll be right back.
What do Mike Mansfield, Pat Williams, John Tester, Bob Brown, and Angela McClain have in common? Mike Mansfield, Senate Majority Leader longer than anyone in U.S. history, led a U.S. Senate that was arguably the most productive in our history. Pat Williams, Montana Congressman for 18 years, longer than anyone in our history, had a record of legislative accomplishment in fields as varied as labor, education, the arts, wildlife preservation, and public lands access. John Tester, now our senior senator, has a demonstrated ability to bring people with strongly divergent views together to deal with contentious issues, and he brings common sense to an otherwise dogmatic debate in Washington, D.C. Bob Brown, a 28-year state legislator and Secretary of State, established a long record of legislative accomplishment and a reputation for across-the-aisle solution-seeking. Angela McClain, newly appointed lieutenant governor, led the Montana Board of Regents under two governors in freezing tuition for Montana students and making higher education more affordable and accessible. What does this diverse group have in common? All were teachers. All were educators. All inspired students to do their best before they inspired policymakers and citizens to come together for the common good. Angela McClain, a world-class teacher appointed lieutenant governor, makes me think about the things that good teachers bring to the public arena, things that distinguish them from the everyday politician. I am so glad to see Angela's bright light shining in the world of politics where so often darkness overwhelms enlightenment. All of these teachers-turned-leaders respected the minds of their students and also respected the voters' intellect. They presented facts and sound logical concepts for voters to critically evaluate and consider. That's unlike so many politicians today who do not try to enlighten their constituents but actually try to manipulate their thinking. In much of today's political world, dogma has replaced reason. Facts have been replaced by beliefs. For many of today's political leaders, you don't have to rationally justify a position if that position is divinely inspired. And if anyone challenges that divinely inspired position, they must be evil. In that world, there is no battle of competing ideas to be considered by the minds of voters and citizens, and there is no basis upon which to find common ground and solutions to move ahead for the benefit of all. If one cannot compromise an article of faith in the political world, that's bad for democracy. When facts and circumstances change, teachers ask their students to reevaluate based upon the evidence and maybe even modify their position. When Mike Mansfield, a true internationalist, observed the reality of U.S. involvement in Vietnam, he was compelled to move from support for that war to opposition, even though it meant a major break with his principal benefactor and friend, President Lyndon Johnson. How does that compare with today's neocon true believers who still try to justify the death and destruction of an Iraq war built upon a fabrication? Pat Williams was raised in Butte, where mining paychecks sustained families for generations. Because of economics, it was in his political interest to turn a blind eye to the environmental devastation that came with old mining practices. But the facts about that devastation were unchallengeable to an open mind and an observant eye, so Pat had to stand for human health and safety. Contrast that with those on the rigid right who uniformly condemn the EPA and any environmental and health enforcement. John Tester could have been guiding a class discussion as he asked longstanding opponents in the wilderness jobs debate to confront facts and commonalities in an effort to break a multi-decade logjam that had stalled both wilderness and jobs. As a teacher, he asked all parties to deal with the facts, seek solutions, not blame, dialogue, not shouting, flexibility, not stridency, opening the door for finding common ground. Bob Brown, as a teacher, legislator, and Secretary of State, believes in a democracy with clean elections based upon factual positions, elections not tainted by dark money, elections that are validated by the broadest citizen participation by voting. To Brown, it is the people who legitimize our democracy, a position that is in contrast to so many today who seek to limit citizen voting because it might give them a political advantage. And none of these teacher leaders followed the political tenet that if you tell a lie long enough and often enough, you can get people to believe it to be the truth. Yes, teachers like Mansfield, Williams, Tester, Brown, and now Angela McLean give one hope that this grand American experiment in democracy can continue to be a guiding light to the world. This is Evan Barrett in Butte, thinking about the teachers among us who daily elevate our human prospects.
Evan Barrett is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station, and if you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtbr.org. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.